Alright, we're at the Agile Revolution. We're at YAO 2013 in Sydney. Craig and Renee here, and it's great to have Michael Nygaard with us. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me.
So you're out here on the YAO tour. We're on the last of three city stops. For those who don't know about your background, give us a bit of a snapshot.
Sure. So my background is either well-rounded or checkered, depending on how charitable you're being.
Well, it's a checkered shirt you're wearing today, so we'll go check it.
Turns out. I've been a developer and architect for more than 20 years, and about 10 years ago, I made the move into IT operations and sort of rounded out that side of my professional skills. While I was in operations, I discovered some interesting things about the software we write and how well it survives contact with the real world. I'll skip to the end. The answer is it doesn't deal with it very well at all. And so I started trying to help people learn how to write software to survive the real world instead of just passing QA. And so now I do talks like this, and I've written a book called Release It on how to make your software survive contact with the real world.
And for me, and I said this in the introduction today, it was a book a little before its time. I think it was there wasn't really much.
2009, is that right?
2007.
2007, actually.
So was that something that you were seeing in organizations that you thought there was a need for? I mean, what was the real impetus behind that book?
So the original genesis of the book was a talk that I gave to one of my local user groups in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. At the end of the talk, Mary Poppendick cornered me, almost grabbed me by the lapels and said, "You must write a book." And so I started thinking about it and said, "Yeah, okay, I guess I have a book here." And I started looking around saying, "Surely someone's already written this book." And I found that no one had. And so it wasn't that I wrote it because I thought the time was right. I wrote it because I thought no one else was talking about it and that it was very important. And that was, you know, before DevOps, before developers really started getting involved in production operations, before a lot of these things happened. So either I got very lucky and wrote it at just the right time, or I had a hand in kind of kicking off that awareness. I'm not sure which. I would love to believe the latter.
Yeah. No. It was certainly. I mean, is there anybody in that in that field before you that you kind of looked up to that were in that was in this space that was prominent? Because I struggle to sort of think there was little pockets, but
yeah, there's actually about a 10-year sort of gap. And if you look before that, there was a lot of work on software safety, particularly in embedded systems and in control systems. So there's a kind of a long history in comp.risks and other places of analyzing software failures with economic consequences. This is where you get stories about, for example, the Ariane 5 rocket veering off course and self-destructing because one part of the software was in meters and another was in feet. I'm sorry, that was Mars Reconnaissance Observer.
Yep.
Ariane 5 was one part was in 32 bits and one was in 16 bits and it overflowed. But all of those areas were sort of relegated to, you know, serious engineering, I guess. You know, things with moving parts and, you know, explodey bits. And we weren't really looking at it in the more economically practical sense for web systems and distributed systems and ordinary enterprise systems.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that the economic losses due to downtime on ordinary web systems far outweigh the losses due to the occasional rocket exploding. Those tend to come all at once, and ordinary web losses are sort of spread out more.
Hmm.
So I guess there was a hiatus, maybe 10 or 15 years, where people weren't really talking about it for sort of ordinary web systems.
I'd always, and maybe this is my misunderstanding of the word DevOps and its origin, I'd always thought that it was mostly around continuous integration, continuous deployment, you know, having environments being able to be built up really quickly, But I guess I got the feeling from your talk that it was quite more extensive than that, that it's more around the working relationship between operations and developers on a day-to-day basis.
That was an excellent summary of my talk. Thank you. I do think that... well, let me back up. I draw an analogy between the Agile practices and the Agile values to the DevOps practices and DevOps values. So in the Agile camp, you'll find practices like unit testing, continuous integration, and pair programming.
Yep.
Those are manifestations of the values. And in some sense, they also help sustain and support the values.
Yes, yeah.
Similarly, in the DevOps arena, we have those things like build pipelines and environment builds. Those are the manifestations of the values. Mm. The values say we want to be able to deliver value continuously, make change, and collaborate.
Yeah.
And it turns out collaboration and making change is facilitated by scripted builds,
yes,
and hindered by sort of hand-feeding of servers.
Yes.
And so I think there's a pretty direct comparison. You know, unit testing is to feedback as build pipeline is to change or collaboration.
So there was a little bit in there for me. I was thinking about the Agile Manifesto and around the individual's interactions over processes and tools.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, again, going back to it's less about process and tools and more about the interactions that we have and the collaboration that we have together.
Yes, I completely agree. And I'll say that it was never phrased as a binary choice in the manifesto,
yes,
right? It's
yes,
over,
yep,
not instead of.
Yep.
And likewise, you know, we favor the interactions over the tools. Unfortunately, the tools happen to be the most visible thing and the most easily replicated thing. It's much easier to download Logstash than it is to really get people to care about what the logs say.
Yep.
And so that's the part that gets replicated. But part of what I'm trying to say, and evidently with some success, is that the culture has to be there as well.
Yep.
So you mentioned the 10-year gap. I'm just wondering, I mean, do you think we could... my feeling is we couldn't be in this space for DevOps if Agile really hadn't have happened and taken off. And I wonder whether that 10-year gap was that it paved the way for us now to actually be having this DevOps discussion and all the tooling and conversation that goes along with it.
That's part of it. I'll say the 10-year gap was also about awareness of production fallacies or production failures for web systems. So it's not all about DevOps, but I do think Agile sort of created a certain set of attitudes, and people were looking for how to extend that that approach to work further upstream and further downstream. So I've been on projects where we were delivering very fast and at, you know, had great velocity, and we actually had to throttle back and remove people from the project because we were delivering features faster than the training group could update the materials and faster than the operations group could redeploy the software and so on. So to an extent, Agile was one of the precursors there. I also think virtualization is another precursor because it actually creates this huge problem around having a vast number of ephemeral machines, and the need to configure those really also leads us in the direction of DevOps.
And I did. I asked you the other day, cornered you, and said that I asked you what would you change if you rewrote release it now, being that you know what's easily what 6 years down the track, and I guess that's one of the big changes from the book is things like virtualization in the cloud that were really not so mature at that point.
Yeah, in fact, I think I have a paragraph or something that mentions virtualization may be a way to solve this in the future, and of course since then to now, you know, virtualization is the first tool we reach for in solving most of these problems. Yeah, there's a good third of the book that I think needs to be updated, but two thirds of it on sort of the stability patterns and anti-patterns still holds well. And I think the section on capacity patterns and anti-patterns holds well.
Mm, absolutely.
Speaking of patterns, I was really quite curious when you were talking about that the purpose is not to build this DevOps group within your organization, and that you'd have this operations group, and then you'd have this development group, and you'd have this DevOps group in the middle collaborating.
I'm going to say hallelujah. Thank you for saying that.
Because I must admit, I have seen that a little.
I have too.
Is that an anti-pattern, and are there more that you're seeing around the DevOps area?
So I'll come out on the record and say I believe it is an anti-pattern, because we're trying to get two groups to work more closely together, and how you achieve that by creating another intermediary and having two handoffs where once there was one, it baffles me. So I definitely think that's an anti-pattern. I think the tools-only approach is also an anti-pattern. I think the DevOps rebels is an anti-pattern. So, you know,
I think I've heard that one.
I've just named it this second.
You're hearing it first here, people.
That explains it.
It's the sort of thing where you have a group that is trying to get out from under the thumb of IT, and so they're doing DevOps by using the secretary's purchasing card to go buy cloud resources and deploy something that IT doesn't know about.
That's sort of the rogue IT.
Yeah, it is. And the problem is, it will last right up until it becomes noticed by authority, and then you have a huge organizational fight that will be unproductive for everyone involved. So it's a very short-term gain followed by a long-term loss.
So one of the things I did want to ask you about, sort of leaving the DevOps aside for a moment, is so you work for a company, it used to be Relevance. I'm never going to get the explanation of this right, but how do you pronounce the new company name?
Yep, so we formerly were a consultancy called Relevance, and now we're a product plus consultancy called Cognitect.
Cognitect, there you go. I wouldn't have got that right. So one of the things that you have in that company as part of your arm is the Clojure, you know, the Clojure family and Clojure Core. How do you see functional languages? I mean, now that they're evolving, how does that all fit into this whole agile DevOps type relationship? Because I sort of see some people still obviously look at the functional languages and go, you know, it's still a bit play and still a bit, you know academic and university. But I think as they become more prevalent, I just haven't seen a lot of people really talking about how to make those things mainstream, but push them into the agile and DevOps world.
It's interesting. I'm not sure that we've actually addressed that question head on, because agile development is just sort of the way that we do things, and functional programming with Clojure is now just sort of the way that we do things. So it's not like we had a discussion or a conscious argument or a decision to do it. It's just...
You'd meet a ski resort in Utah and with 17 people and say, hey, this is how we're going to do it?
We did not do that, no. But there are some things that we do differently. So, for example, testing. We tend to do less unit testing with functional programming than we would have before, because without mutation, it just turns out that there are fewer states to explore. Where we do testing at the sort of unit scale, we're tending to use generative testing. And generative testing you can think of as a cut-down version of Quick Check or Scala Check, where we describe the inputs to a function. This is a Boolean that's equally likely to be true or false. This one is a string that must be at least four characters. And then we let the framework generate millions of calls with different randomized parameters, and we check the invariance that we expect. So you can think of it like unit testing if you were to sit and write, you know, a million calls to the unit under test. So we do that a lot more than we do unit testing these days. I also think we're spending more time on design and paired design than we typically would have before. But I'm not sure how much of that has to do with the inherent functional nature of Clojure or our tools, and how much is just that, you know, when you're doing Ruby on Rails work, 80% of the architecture is defined before you've written a line of code. And so there's not that much to discuss compared to, you know, I have an empty namespace and what am I going to do with it?
So it's almost forcing that collaboration, probably a little more.
It does force you to think more about the design and architecture of your system, definitely.
Excellent.
For some people, that's fine, and other people will consider that a detriment at the moment.
I would love to hear a little bit more about the concept that you had around development is production. So for those listening, what does that mean?
Sure. So development is production. What I'm trying to say with that is, in the old days when you deploy code once a quarter or once a month.
Not necessarily very old days for some people who are listening, maybe.
Apologies.
You're in Australia here, we're a little behind.
So in those days, it's sort of normal if QA is not always available, right? Mm. Or if you can't get into QA because someone else is there and another release has to exit QA before you get in.
Yep, yep.
Or if the dev tools are offline for a day because they're being upgraded, that's sort of okay. Or if the build server is down for a while, you know, it's just normal. So that what I'm talking about with dev as production is, as you increase the frequency of releases and you move towards something like a continuous flow, the tools that you use to create code or produce features and release them to your system becomes just as important as the content management systems that your marketers use for updating content, or the business management tools that your business uses to control the financial outcomes. So your development tools have to be treated as production-grade infrastructure for the purpose of delivering features to your system.
Right, so it's about not just looking at the tools that we use to not just looking at delivery to production and the value stream for that, but also everything that goes into
all the infrastructure you use.
All the infrastructure that you use. Yep.
So if you have a build pipeline, it needs to be available all the time. Especially if your solution to a production problem is to roll code forward, then you know your timeline for fixing a production bug is now gated by the availability of your build pipeline.
Yeah.
So it better be available.
Yeah.
What I don't mean by development as production is that you now have to fill out change request forms to change your dev environment. Okay, that would not be facilitating continuous delivery of value.
So you had a little go at ITIL in the talk, but more less so at the actual process itself and more at how people implement ITIL. Are you seeing a trend and change as DevOps is becoming more popular of people focusing less on things like ITIL?
I'm not sure I could characterize a trend. I don't have enough data points to extrapolate.
Yep.
I can say, you know, my experience or my observation is people are more interested in DevOps these days. The people I've spoken to are more interested in DevOps than in ITIL these days.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be, you know, probably 10 years ago, if we actually used, again, your data point before, 10 years ago it was, this is the only way we can manage this type of thing. And whilst people are still walking around, I think, using that framework as a guide, you know, when they get into trouble, it doesn't seem to be, oh, but hang on, page 37 of the ITIL manual says, actually, I shouldn't say page 37, page 3,700 of the ITIL manual says, dot, dot, dot.
It's interesting. I've actually read all of the ITIL V2 books. There aren't many people who've actually read it. It's like asking who's read the entire Bible.
And pretty we much may the have, same type of thing too, right?
We may have passed peak ITIL. but I think it's important to remember where that came from. So ITIL came from from IT operations for mainframe shops in the 1980s.
Hmm.
The volume of change that they dealt with was so much less than we deal with today. And the competitive nature and the economic value of the systems they were dealing with was so much less than what we're dealing with today.
Doesn't that make the value of it still relevant? So having that common language, having some sort of defined mechanism in process to say, you know, how are we going to deal with problems or incidents as they come in? Not necessarily the change part, but more around the problem management, because we're deploying more frequently.
Yeah, I am. Except I'll this may be a bit unfair because I've actually been through the ITIL certification classes and I had my foundation certificate for V2 and all of that. When you look at the processes themselves, the ITIL books are very clear that they provide a framework for building IT management processes. They do not provide the processes per se.
Correct, yeah.
And so one implementation may differ quite a bit from another.
Yep.
Another thing that I'll say is, particularly when it comes to problems, the problem management process sort of assumes that problems are going to persist for some long period of time.
Mm.
Right? So a problem goes through these stages of, you know, unknown cause, unknown workaround, then to a known workaround state, then to a known solution, and then actually you don't really solve a problem in the problem management process. You eventually feed that into change management to get a change released. Yeah. And then you don't actually change anything in the change management process. It's release management that actually applies changes. And so when you look at these processes, they do sort of assume that you're going to have a problem existing for some period of time and have a service desk that's applying remediation. Well, what happens when you go through the entire life cycle of a problem to change to release in 15 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
How does that life cycle even apply? I mean, if you don't have a problem
in 15 minutes, aren't you? You're still going, well, what's caused this particular problem? Let me fix it. Let me release it.
But what you're talking about there is just a basic troubleshooting process, not the problem management process as ITIL defines it. ITIL says that you should have a problem manager and it should be assigned to someone.
Well, that's the dev that's fixing it, right?
Perhaps. It also says that you need to communicate to the service desk when you've identified the known workaround so that they can apply the workaround every time the problem occurs. Well, except that the service desk may not be in a position to apply the problem because it could be happening 100 times a minute.
Mm.
It's almost like a lean process. We've eliminated that waste by shortening the process. But I think the key things that when you say... I see the same analogies with the project management, like the PMI, as well as even the testing, the testing frameworks like the ISTQB, that they're base frameworks that are good for a raw knowledge, but none of them were meant to be, as you said, a prescriptive framework. And I think one of the places where people have gone wrong is, they've taken the rightful Bible with them and said, let's implement this. And I've seen some horror installations of this in the past.
I think what I try to bring it back to is what is the goal that you're attempting to achieve by implementing ITIL? And usually people will say control, but what they really mean underneath is risk management. They want to understand and reduce the losses to their business from errors in IT.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, okay, given that, I can work with that. Let's look at where the losses come from. And you can basically take a quantitative risk management approach and say losses come from the probability of a negative event occurring times the number of opportunities for that event to occur times the cost when it does occur. And if I can affect any of those three variables, then I'm improving things. ITIL focuses entirely on the probability of the events.
Mm.
I think what we're looking at when we talk about continuous delivery and very short cycles is a dramatic increase in the number of opportunities for things to fail.
Mm. But also an increase in the opportunities to fix it or the speed to fix it, right?
Right. So we reduce the cost of a negative event by speeding up how long it takes to fix it, right? We shorten the time and we apply other techniques like canary releases to reduce the scope in breadth of how far it goes.
So one last thing I kind of want to ask you is, based on, I mean, you talk at these conferences all around the world, what's your sense of DevOps engagement? You kind of mentioned where we are on the hype cycle in the talk, but actually how good are we?
It's interesting. The most common request that I get is from operations groups who say, we want to move in this direction and we don't know how to get more engagement from dev.
Wow.
Which is just the opposite of what I would have expected.
Yeah.
So if you have devs who are saying, we want to do this and we don't know how to get ops to do it, and you've got ops who's saying the same thing in reverse, then maybe they should all just go out for beers together and talk and say, what's the first small step we can make in this direction?
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. I said I always hear from the other side, but maybe that's because I relate more to the developer side that you're talking to those guys. So, yeah.
I'll say I've heard it from a couple of companies that I've just visited this week and last week right here in Australia.
Okay.
The ops is really keen on it. Even product management is keen on it, and they want more engagement from dev.
Do you think it's partly that the ops don't really, part of it is though, sometimes I've seen when the devs come in is that they almost try to tell the ops what to do rather than actually collaborating and here's our version control system and here's the script that you must run to do it and here's what you should name it. And
I would not be pleased to see that approach, I'll say that. The other thing though that can get in the way is project management approaches to dev projects.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a deadline and the only thing that matters is getting everything code complete and passed QA by that deadline, there's not a lot of room for collaboration and engagement. And so, you know, if you've got a dev project where it's scheduled down to the last minute and there's no Slack for anything, you know, maybe the, you know, hasn't been descoped to an appropriate degree, then, you know, any group coming in and saying we'd like to talk to you about something else can be a threat to that project.
Yes.
And this is where there's a divergence in goals between the project and the product, or the project and the company.
Yep.
And of course, we've got to look out for the, would you say, the bus backing up and the DevOps consultants running at the back. Though I think that was the quote of the talk for me. Awesome. Well, thanks for your time. If people want to know more about you, Michael, where should they find you on the?
Well, I'm on Twitter as at MT Nygaard. That's NYGARD. I can also be found on the Think Relevance blog. We haven't moved that to the new domain yet, so it's thinkrelevance.com/blog, where I try to say something about every 2 weeks. Not always successful at that schedule, but I try. So those would be the best places to find me.
Cool. And obviously, we were talking about maybe at some point you might think about updating the book or a new book potentially to follow up on the.
Yeah, no comment.
No pressure.
No pressure. No, it'd be good to see. As I said in my opening, it was a book before its time, and I'm glad it was out there because it was the first step in, I think, starting to educate people. And in fact, I still find it relevant, even though you say some of it's out of date, because there's so many legacy systems out there. Most of it actually still holds true, and you're starting people just to get thinking about it, even if they're not down that cloud path. So, yeah, it's been awesome to catch up with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.